Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from The Lancet Neurology. It's October 2022 and I'm Sarah Passy. This month, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Mieke Zielmans from the University Medical Centre at Utrecht, whose new research on tailoring of epilepsy surgery is published in our issue this month. Welcome, Mieke. So in your trial, you included patients with epilepsy who were referred for surgery. Can you please explain what type of epilepsy or patient group is suitable for a surgical approach to treatment?
Thank you. So it's focal epilepsy. So that's epilepsy that really comes from one spot in the brain, and you have to know where to find that spot. That's the whole thing we're searching for. So this can be a lot of different pathologies like focal cortical dysplasia, or a cavernoma, or mesial temporal sclerosis. So they all have to be at least one clear spot that the surgeon can take out. It can be even patients who show no abnormalities at all at the MRI. And so it's not just the abnormalities at the MRI, which are important, but also it can be the surrounding tissue that produces the epilepsy, even though you don't see any abnormalities there. So those are the patients who are suitable. And then up till now, epilepsy surgery is done usually as a sort of last resort treatment. So it's in patients who have tried medication, and if the medication does not work enough or gives a lot of side effects, people go for surgery. But it's more and more shifting nowadays towards becoming an earlier treatment, because the thing is, like, if you treat people in an early stage of their disease, hopefully the disease is still not too complex, but also the devastating effect it can have on the development of the brain, for instance, in children, can be stopped. So that's why, especially also in children, we feel you should not wait too long to go for surgery if the epilepsy is worse enough to have a great impact on people's lives.
You compared two biomarkers in your study, which were interictal spikes and high-frequency oscillations. And these can be used to identify brain tissue that causes seizures. So you use a technique called electrocorticography. Could you briefly explain to our listeners what this technique entails and why it is used? And please give us some background to the two biomarkers and why they were chosen.
What we call the interictal spikes is the biomarker that has been used for the whole time up till now. And the high frequency oscillations are a newly found biomarker, like 20 years ago, were found to be maybe more specific for the epileptogenic area. And what electrocorticography does is you put a grid with electrodes during surgery over the cortex, and you can measure these electrical phenomena in the EEG, in the electrical signal. And what we usually do is we stop propofol and then we wait for a while, and we record, and we usually record at one side and then at another side. And then the surgeon takes out, usually if there's a clear lesion, then he takes out first the MRI lesion, then we record again. But if we then still see biomarkers on the on this electrocorticography, then the surgeon may extend the resection if that's feasible, also functionally, because of course you can't remove the whole brain. But in this way, we tailor the resection using these electrode grids.
So you mentioned in your report about ethical concerns some colleagues in the field have had about basing surgical decisions on novel biomarkers. Could you please explain how you overcame these concerns?
Yeah, we ourselves, of course, had the same ethical concerns, because, yeah, you perform surgery based on something, well, first it's new, and second, we knew that, for instance, you could also, an artifact can look like an high-frequency oscillation or an HFO. And of course, you don't want to take out brain based on an artifact or based on maybe physiological activity. And on the other hand, on the sides of the spikes, spikes are being used in some centers. In some centers, they do not use electrocorticography, so they just perform surgery without this knowledge. There seems to be some advantage, but it's not 100% clear. What is clear is that interictal spike patterns, so really patterns that look like a seizure, are important. So one thing we did is that if we looked at the high frequency oscillations, we also looked at the ictiform spike patterns. And another thing is that we had two reviewers for the EEG, so to make sure that there were no artifacts. Also, we stopped all machinery that could cause artifacts. We had to take enough time. In case there was doubt, we just recorded for a little bit longer. So those were ways to be sure that what we were seeing was relevant. And of course, everything happened in collaboration with the surgeon. And the electrocorticography was not the only measure. We also looked at the MRI. We also had our clinical information and just, yeah, ways to know if this makes sense, what we were doing, which is normal, because also in the regular clinical practice, you also have the MRI and the clinical story and maybe a PET scan or a SPECT scan next to the electrocorticography.
So you also encountered some difficulties, practical difficulties, during your study in the operating theatre. Could you explain what these difficulties were and how you remedied them?
Yeah, we encountered several challenges. I named one already, which is the artifacts. In the operation theatre, there's a lot of machinery which gives artifacts. For instance, the heating blanket of the patient, the coagulator, the microscope for the surgeon. And we learned to put all those things out. We stopped all of them. So that's one thing. And then another thing is, of course, we had to record for a little bit longer, we figured. So we need the patience of the neurosurgeon, who are usually people who, you know, like to continue their work. So that's also a thing we encountered. We just needed time and we needed to stop the propofol to really get clear high-frequency oscillations visible. So that's a practical thing we encountered. Another practical thing we encountered is the recording methods we had ourselves. We found out during the study that made some difference which things were used. So that was important. And then the decision making is, of course, also a big challenge because as we already discussed before, you don't want to just hunt the spikes or the HFOs. You want to be aware what you are doing. And one thing what was important in that was the physiological activity. So if we saw HFOs that looked like physiological activity, for instance, they were in areas where you would expect them, like in the language, the dominant language areas, Broca, Wernicke, or around the hippocampus, we were aware that this could be physiological activity. We looked if there was a co-occurring spike. We looked how long the signal, if it was more like a waxing and waning pattern, or it were very sporadic events that made a difference between physiological and pathological activity. So, yeah, to overcome that, we just tried to be aware of where we were recording and what we were seeing.
So, can you explain the key findings of your study, please?
The key findings were, we found we wanted to show, actually, it's a bit of a complex trial. We wanted to show non-inferiority of the high-frequency oscillations compared to the spikes. The reasons why we wanted to show non-inferiority was that our thought when we began was that we want to show that it's at least not doing worse than the spikes, that at least the seizure outcome is the same in both groups. And we thought maybe because the HFOs are more specific for the epileptogenic tissue, that maybe the area that would be resected would be smaller. So we took the resection area, for instance, as a secondary outcome measure. What we found in our first analysis is actually that we did not show non-inferiority for HFOs compared to spikes. Also not in our subgroups of temporal lobe epilepsy and extratemporal lobe epilepsy. And even there's a suggestion that maybe the spikes are even doing a little bit better than the HFOs. But then what we also encountered is that the groups were very unequal in their distribution. It's a relatively small study with 78 patients. And yeah, when they were distributed amongst the groups, before you could think, okay, there are some patients who will have probably maybe the chances that they will have a good outcome is less than for other patients. And there are some very specific patient groups where this is the case. For instance, people with tuberous sclerosis or with other kinds of dual pathology. And we saw that those people were more occurring more in the group with HFOs. And in our stratification protocol, we did not correct for that. We only corrected for temporal lobe epilepsy versus extratemporal lobe epilepsy. So then we took this correction. We corrected the data for this difference because we knew it had a great effect on the outcome. And then we find that for the seizure outcome, that still for the whole group, we do not prove non-inferiority. And only for the extratemporal lobe patients, we found non-inferiority for the HFOs compared to the spikes.
So what are the implications then of those findings for clinical practice?
Yeah, of course you may think, well, maybe that's a coincidence, the difference between temporal lobe epilepsy and extratemporal lobe epilepsy. I think it's not a coincidence because often in temporal lobe epilepsy, the question is not just the lesion and the extent of the resection of the lesion, but often the question is also, do I have to take out the hippocampus also, yes or no? And for that question, we know actually that I already talked about physiological events, and these physiological high-frequency oscillations are found especially in the hippocampus, and it's difficult to distinguish them from pathological ones. We performed a study next to this study in patients outside of the study population to see if indeed the HFOs in the hippocampus could help in the decision if you have to remove the hippocampus, yes or no. And actually for that study also the conclusion was that probably they're not that useful for that question. So I think that our results mean that we should focus on the extratemporal lobe epilepsy for the future research on high frequency oscillations, maybe also on temporal lobe epilepsies, but then only the ones where there's just a lesion and you don't consider the hippocampus. So for instance, in the back part of the temporal lobe, yeah, you can imagine that the hippocampus is not involved, and then this may be useful, but especially for the, I think that our future research should focus on the extratemporal lobe epilepsies and then especially on the extent of the lesion. I think still that there it may make sense to look at this this signal.
You've talked a little bit about sort of future work, but are there any other next steps for this line of research?
Yeah, our big next step is recording with more high-density electrode grids, because if you just have more recording points, you record much more information, and we see that we find more of these high-frequency oscillations. I also already mentioned it matters with what type of EEG machinery you work. So the EEG head box actually makes a difference. So that's also part of our future research to look into that. And another part is we think it's especially interesting to look at the recordings after the resection. So we are developing electrode grids which are especially flexible, and then we can maybe use them to record really from the resection cavity after the resection. So those are three things where our research focuses on now.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting. So you can read Professor Zimmern's research online now at thelancet.com. Thank you, Maker, for joining me today, and thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With, The Lancet Neurology, wherever you usually get your podcasts.